Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores and our author programs. We really appreciate it. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce David Abrams, who will talk about his debut novel, Fobbit, which is a sort of comedy about the tragedy of war. It's already been compared to Catch-22, Slaughterhouse-5, and even MASH. And I read it, and I really liked it because it gave an interesting perspective about Iraq. And I'll let David explain the Fobbit situation and the definition. But the reason why I really liked it is it rang true, and that's because David Abrams has served 20 years in active duty Army as a journalist, and he received the Department of Defense's Military Journalist of the Year Award during that time. And then in 2005, he served with the 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq, and his short stories have appeared in Esquire and numerous reviews and journals. So please welcome David Abrams.
Thank you, Lisa, and thanks to the staff of Tattered Cover. This is, Tattered Cover TC, I'm here. Can't believe this. But thanks to the staff here, and thanks to all of you for coming out and hearing me ramble for a little bit. Hopefully I won't ramble. My wife says I tend to ramble, so hold up the ramble sign if I get too bad. So I want to talk a little bit about myself and the genesis of the book, and then I'll read a little bit and take questions if you guys have any. Before I begin, though, it's a great experience it's a great feeling to be here at the Tattered Cover because I'm coming on the heels of another great Iraq War veteran novelist. Last night, Kevin Powers was here. I just flew in this afternoon, so I didn't have a chance to see him. I haven't met him, but I have read The Yellow Birds, and if you have not read The Yellow Birds, need to go upstairs and buy yourself a copy after you buy Fobbit and read it. It is just, it's a powerful, it's lyrical, it's moving, it'll break your frickin' heart, and it'll tell you a lot of things about Iraq that my book doesn't. You know, we're kind of like the chocolate and vanilla of the Iraq War, two different sides of the conflict, but it's really great. So can't say enough good things about Kevin's book. So here's a little bit of my backstory. In 2005, as Lisa said, I went to war. I was active duty. By that point, I'd been in the Army for 17 years, and most of my coworkers had already been to war, come back, been to war, come back. And there I was, sitting back stateside in air conditioning and writing stories for the Post newspapers. I was in journalism. I was in public affairs, is what we call it in the Army. And I watched all these people go to war, come back, changed in whatever way. And I never had that experience. I thought I would go through my entire career, because I was at 17 years at that point. I thought I'd go through my entire career never having seen the anger of a bullet. Then in 2004, I came down on orders to report to the 3rd Infantry Division at Fort Stewart, Georgia. And I knew when I got those orders that they were next in the rotation to go over to Iraq. So I was in Alaska at the time when I got the order. So I knew when we moved to Georgia, I would be soon going off to war. And that was kind of exciting and scary and all the emotions that you think might be going through somebody that has never been to war. I was enlisted, so by that point I was an NCO, a non-commissioned officer. I was an E7, so I was a leader of men and women, but I didn't know the first thing about how to lead them over there when we went. So that was kind of where I was at on January 2nd, 2005, when I got on that plane. When I got on that plane, though, I should also tell you that I got on that plane as a novelist, as a writer. I was a writer and a novelist before I was a soldier. As Lisa mentioned, I'd been writing stories and getting some things published here and there. Big stuff, and, you know, like Pollywog Review and, you know, Clackamas or whatever. So some of the smaller stuff. But I went with that mindset of observing and just trying to gather in everything that people said and I heard and I tasted and I smelled and everything. So every day I would go back to my trailer, we call it a hooch, and I would sit there and I would write in my journal. I had kept a daily journal. Every day I wrote in the journal. And out of that is kind of the blueprint of what eventually turned into this book. This book is novel, is a novel. It's fiction. You can say it's loosely autobiographical, but it is purely made up. Everybody wants to know what the real things are. And I was like, I don't know. You know, they're all real in my head. So let me get to my notes here. I also went as a reader. I was just talking with Dave here about how I took a footlocker over with like 60 books. That was equal to like 250 pounds of books probably. So I took Don Quixote. I took the complete works of Charles Dickens and all of these books that I've been wanting to read. I figured I had an entire year away from my wife. I love my wife. God bless her. But, you know, when you're over there in the solitude of combat, then you have all this time to read. So I did a lot of reading, too. And it won't, probably won't surprise you, the very first book I read when I got on that plane in 2005 was Catch-22. And that was the first, by Joseph Heller, if you don't know it. That was the first time I'd read that book. So that was a good prelude to what I would be seeing. It got me in the right mindset to when I went, for when I went to war. And obviously loved the book. And it influenced me and really kind of changed my life, I think, in the way I approached war. So, like I said, I didn't know what to expect when I went over there. I thought, never having been before, never really talked to anybody that did, I thought it'd be like a year-long camping trip with weekly showers and sand in my underwear every day and just kind of a grody experience, I guess. But it turned out that I spent almost all my time in a cubicle under fluorescent lights in air conditioning, writing press releases and talking to the media on the phone. I never, as they say, went outside the wire. This is the concertina wire surrounding the base. I was at Camp Liberty in Baghdad, which was almost smack dab between Baghdad International Airport and Abu Ghraib prison. So that's kind of geographically where I was at. And I worked, you know, 12-hour days. And like I said, when I got off work, I went and wrote, read, watched movies on my DVD player, grabbed a few hours of sleep, got up, shaved, showered, ate, went to work, came back home, rinse, repeat. You know, just kept doing the same thing every day. Eventually that year, most of the things I started seeing around me, all the kind of kooky and odd things, I took note of all those in my journal, and eventually those things started to coalesce into a story of some sort. And eventually I realized, about midway through the tour over there, I realized I had the makings of a novel. So a fobbit, real fast, is... it's a slang term for soldiers who generally avoid combat while staying back on the forward operating base, which is called a FOB. You don't really want to be called a FOBbit, but, you know, as Dave and I have said, we were both FOBbits. So it's just something that you are. And so the book follows basically two groups of soldiers. It follows some public affairs FOBbits who are kind of putting the spin on the war, with their news releases and everything. And then it follows some combat arms soldiers who their commander is out there and he is maybe not the best commander in the world and he makes some rash decisions here and there. gets everybody into a mess, and then the Fobbits have to kind of clean up. That's the plot in a nutshell. But there's a lot of characters and a lot of different things that go on. So it is a comedy. You hopefully will laugh. You may wince at the same time you're laughing, because there's some, you know, pretty gruesome stuff in it. But I don't want to taint you. You know, if you don't laugh, I'm cool with that too. So anyways, that is enough rambling. Somebody held up the rambling sign, so I better move on. So I am going to read you tonight the scene where we are introduced to Lieutenant Colonel Eustace Harkleroade, and he is the public affairs officer for the 7th Armored Division, which is fictional. He is the public affairs officer at the heart of the novel. This is the first time we're meeting him, and the other character that you'll meet, that you've already met in the book, is Staff Sergeant Chance Gooding Jr., and he works for Lieutenant Colonel Harkleroade. He's on the public affairs staff. He writes press releases and so on and so forth. So at the time that we pick up the scene, Gooding has just written, or is trying to write, a press release about a U.S. soldier who's been killed in action, and then Harkleroade must go and get that release approved by the higher-ups in his chain of command. Lieutenant Colonel Eustace Harkleroade was a thick man. Thick in the way a bowl of risen dough is said to be thick. He filled his uniform amply. In truth, there was more flesh than fabric. When he leaned back in his chair, other soldiers flinched, afraid a button would pop off, come flying across the room, and put out an eye. Furthermore, Eustace Harkleroade, forever shortened by his mother to Stacy, which had caused him no end of agony over the past 40-odd years, was a spontaneous nosebleeder. Staff Sergeant Gooding knew that if he didn't get this killed-in-action press release done quickly and to the exacting standards of the commanding general, the PAO's nose would start dripping red like a spigot. Gooding didn't tell his boss he was writing this release based on the barest, unsubstantiated nod from G1 casualty. What Harkleroade didn't know wouldn't hurt either him or the rest of the world. Besides, this press release had already been ping-ponging around division headquarters for the past 50 minutes, at least 4 hours and 10 minutes after the charred body had cooled somewhere out there in Al-Kark. And the Task Force Baghdad Public Affairs Office merely needed to tell the media what they thought they already knew. The press release was just another useless, redundant scrap of information in the reporters' email inboxes, and 8 times out of 10 would be deleted without being read. But to the majors, lieutenant colonels, and generals running around division headquarters in a constant state of ass pucker, the press release was as important as an edict from the Pope. In its life cycle, the press release went through several layers of approval and sometimes contradictory editing by the various staff officers along the way. From Staff Sergeant Gooding, it went to Lieutenant Colonel Harkleroade, who would red-pen the sentences, give it back to Gooding for corrections, then distribute it to several other staff officers, intelligence and security, plans and operations, staff judge advocate, provost marshal, sometimes even the chaplain got a say-so, before hand-carrying it upstairs to the command group, where Harkleroade would give it to the chief of staff's secretary, fingers trembling, nose already tingling with the threat of blood, and wait outside the chief's office door while the secretary ventured inside to place the press release on the colonel's desk. He would be blasted with either a bark of, "What is it now?" or a battle-weary, "All right, let me have it. And for God's sake, tell Harkleroade to stop sniffing out there." Lieutenant Colonel Harkleroade did his best to suck the beginning drips of blood back into his nostrils and prayed the chief read the press release before he couldn't snuffle it up anymore, and he had to walk in there to retrieve the paper with a tissue wad sticking out of his nose. The chief of staff, a colonel named Belcher, had lost his temper right around the time he lost all of his hair, age 30. He was known and feared on Army staffs as the man whose bald head perpetually glowed like an overheated thermometer. While he waited, Harkleroade kept the left side of his body angled toward the chief's office door. Now, Stacy's right eardrum had been punctured when he'd stepped too close to a howitzer during artillery training 11 years ago. Then Captain Harkleroade had been thinking about his mother's church group in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and how at their Wednesday Bible study meetings, Eulalie Constance Harkleroade, Connie at her insistence, would announce to the other ladies fanning themselves with Our Daily Bread the latest accomplishments of her son Stacy as he made a name for himself in the United States Army. Most of what his mother relayed to the First Church of Redemption ladies were half-truths Stacy Harkleroad needed and pulled like silly putty for her benefit. "Well, Mother, today I led my men on a 12-mile road march in the pouring rain." He'd stop to tie his bootlaces at the 3-mile mark, telling his first sergeant to continue on with the rest of the company and he'd catch up, then surreptitiously slipping back to headquarters. "Next month, I'm taking my company on a joint training exercise to Italy." The 3-day command post exercise had taken place right there at Fort Knox, Kentucky. The staff officer sat at a bank of computers and moved icons around a map of the Italian Alps, while a group of Air Force officers at Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming and Marines at 29 Palms in California did the same thing, each of them trying to outmaneuver the other until the exercise observer controllers called game over. "Yes, Mother, yes, the brigade commander is certain I'll be promoted this year. It's just a matter of checking the right blocks on my annual evaluation form." The colonel barely knew Stacy existed, called him Harrison every time he saw him, despite the fact Harkleroad was embroidered above the breast pocket of his uniform. Eustace had gotten so deep into the habit of lying to his mother to fuel her Wednesday evening Bible studies that he wasn't sure how to stop, except to one day actually do something that, if not exactly brave or significant, would at least have the truth as its foundation. This is what he had been thinking as the gun crew prepared the artillery round for deployment on that day 11 years ago. The idea entered Harkleroad's head that if he was the one to pull the lanyard and fire the howitzer, he would actually give his mother something to bust her buttons over. He started walking toward the gun crew with his great idea, but he was half an idea too late. He was 3 paces away and in the midst of saying, "Here, Sergeant, let me," when the squad leader gave a huge tug on the lanyard, the rest of the crew having already bent over, plugging their ears. There was a belch of smoke. The howitzer recoiled, and Harkleroad's right ear popped like a hot tomato. He was thrown to the ground in inky silence. Since then, he was forced to cock his head in order to catch the mumbled words that fell off his superior's lips, hoping he could fake his way through the conversation with a nod or a grimace, as seemed appropriate from his best guess of what had been said. And so, 3/4 of the way through the life cycle of a typical press release, he would wait outside the division chief of staff's office, straining to catch a meaningful cough, sigh, or an outright, "What the fuck is this shit?" Once the chief had read and initialed the press release, it went one of 2 places, back into Harkleroad's hands for more corrections and a subsequent review, or to the commanding general's desk for his approval. Harkleroad would then have to position himself outside the CG's door and pray that he was a mercifully fast reader, too. Stacy Harkleroad had, on too many occasions, stood in front of the CG's desk with 1 nostril plugged and a dry delta of blood on his upper lip, the general trying not to look at his pathetic face because it would only make him scowl and want to kick his PAO's ass from here to Ankara. The majority of Harkleroad's time in Baghdad had been spent anxiously dabbing at his nostrils while waiting for pieces of paper to be initialed and approved. So that's our introduction to Stacy. And in the course of the novel, he writes several emails to his mother. And as you can see, as you already saw, he's a bit of a blowhard and he's a mother's boy. So combine those two, and this is the kind of email that you will get. To Eulalie Harkleroad at U, or no, from Eustace Har- sorry, from Eustace Harkleroad at usarmy.mil to Eulalie1935@gmail.com. Subject: Dispatch from a War Zone, Day 193. Mother: First of all, thanks for the care package. The mixed nuts, foot powder, dried apricots, and church bulletins were most appreciated. Unfortunately, the goo-goo clusters did not make it through the Iraqi heat so well. But I put them to good use anyway. I gave them to our translator, Hussein. No, he's no relation to Saddam, who had never tasted goo-goo clusters before. Hussein's family is quite poor, even though they are considered middle class here in Baghdad. How poor are they, you ask? Well, do you remember the Borsippis who used to live up the road from the Macklins before the mill shut down, and they, the Borsippis, had to move all the way up to Pittsburgh? Well, Hussein and his wife and their 5 children and Hussein's wife's father, 2 cousins and their wives and children all crammed together into 1 3-bedroom apartment are worse off than the Borsippis. For instance, they, the Husseins, not the Borsippis, did not even own a TV until last year. And when at last they got one, you would have thought it was a national holiday. Or so Hussein tells me. Now I cannot get him to shut up about 2.5 men. Oh, speaking of which, I hope you are still taping Survivor for me. And do not, under any circumstances, tell me who gets voted off. I want to be surprised when I come home on my R&R leave next month. Speaking of which, are you as excited as I am? I cannot wait to get back to Murfreesboro and out of this combat zone, even if it is only for 2 weeks. 2 weeks of clean sheets, driving on the right side of the road, and your cornflake-crusted meatloaf will do me worlds of good, I believe. I am thoroughly bushed these days. Oh, which brings to mind something else I keep forgetting to mention to you. Whether you like it or not, I do not know. When the men around headquarters here say they're bushed, what they really mean is that they're sick and tired of our president keeping us, the U.S., in this country where, secretly, those men think we don't belong. I know, Mother, I know. I don't particularly appreciate their Democrat-tainted humor either. But that's just the way it is with some of my colleagues. These, I might add, are the lower-class officers. Men who will never amount to much, will never get promoted beyond the limits of their nearsightedness. Men like Jeb Standish down at the mill, who let the loss of 3 fingers keep him from advancing any higher than bobbin tender. Of course, his wife doing all that drinking and nagging didn't help matters either. Now, yours truly, of course, has ambitions, goals, and the drive to get there. So when I say I'm bushed, I certainly don't mean it in the same way those other men do. But the truth is, I am wrung dry inside and out with the daily cycle of activities over here. I do not want to burden you with too much in the way of worry, but you've heard that old expression, war is hell? Well, hell has nothing on this place, let me tell you. I am kept awake each night by the scream of mortars streaking across the sky. It is worse than the semis on I-24. Last week, the enemy finally got lucky and one of the rockets landed on FOB Triumph. You may not have heard about it on the 5 o'clock news on WSMV because we try to keep a lid on those kind of tragic incidents over here. My boss is a big one on good news. And besides, there's only so much tragedy we should burden the American public with, right? But yes, a rocket did fall smack dab in the middle of the post-exchange courtyard in the smack dab middle of the day. And guess who happened to be there at the time, patronizing one of the little shops run by the local Iraqi vendors who sell rugs and jewelry and discount copies of the latest TV movies? Yes, yours truly. Oh, do not worry, Mother. I am not writing this to you from the hospital. I was not at the site of impact, but was on the other side of the courtyard paying for my purchase from a friendly little rug merchant named Benzir. Oh, by the way, I will be shipping back a nice surprise to you. And just to confirm, the dimensions of the living room are such that they will accommodate something that is, oh, say, 18 by 24 feet. The explosion knocked me forward into the arms of Benzir, and after we had dusted each other off and he had given me my change, I rushed directly over to the smoking crater to see what I could do to help. Would you believe no one else was running toward the impact zone? That's right, not a single blankety-blank person. Everyone else was running away, and as it turned out, your son was the only one to move forward to give comfort and aid to the wounded. I could hear other folks yelling at me to take cover and save myself, but I put my hearing loss to good use and just continued to walk toward what I immediately could tell was a very bad scene. I will spare you all the horrific details, but do you remember that movie we once watched, the one with Brad Pitt and the serial killer, and you had to cover your eyes during that one scene until I told you it was okay to look again? Well, what I saw in that there in that PX courtyard was 10 times worse, maybe even 11 times worse. I could see right away at least 2, maybe even 3 of the soldiers who had been sitting at the picnic table eating their Burger King sandwiches were goners. And not just goners, but completely gone. Disintegrated, if you will. No, thank goodness I did not know any of the victims in this vicious and brutal enemy attack. I knelt and said a brief prayer for their departed souls, and then I brushed aside whatever feelings were welling up in me, and I hurried to do what I could for the rest of the wounded. I felt a little like Clara Barton on the battlefield, or was that Molly Pitcher? Well, as I said, no one else was running out from behind the protective concrete barriers to help, so I had to do the best I could all by myself. I will spare you the burden of knowing what all the specific wounds I treated were like, but many of those poor soldiers turned out to be so bad they had to be shipped out of Iraq, back to Germany, and then all the way to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in our nation's capital, where they will have to undergo months of recovery and rehabilitation. That's how bad their injuries are. So there I was, moving from victim to victim, dressing wounds and stopping the bleeding with tourniquets, and, in one case, performing CPR to bring one young girl with especially plump lips back to life. It was a real mess, and suffice to say, the uniform I was wearing that day is no good anymore, and I had to toss it away. I'm not going to lie to you, Mother. I was quite sickened that day by the horrors of what I saw, but I take comfort in knowing I saved some lives, and those soldiers will go on to fight another day. In anticipation of what I know, you will ask, no, I do not know if I will get a commendation or medal of some kind for my actions that day. I do know the Chief of Staff, Colonel Belcher, is quite proud of me, and even the Commanding General himself interrupted yesterday's staff meeting to make some mention of what he called my unselfish act of courage. I tend to think I won't receive any specific award for what I did, not because they don't think I don't deserve it, but because, like so much of what we do here, we're trying to keep all of this on the hush-hush and down low. It would only give comfort and aid to the enemy if they knew they succeeded in a bullseye hit on our PX at FOB Triumph. So that is why you won't see me on the evening news or in the Daily Tennessean. In fact, there was a Stars and Stripes reporter who happened to be on the scene when the rocket hit. But I ordered her to delete the photos on her digital camera and hold the story until given approval by the proper authorities in division headquarters, which, ha-ha, jokes on her, is me. As I said, I don't want to burden you with all of my horror stories, but I thought you should know what your son is doing over here in the name of democracy and freedom. Now, because this is top secret information I'm telling you, I beg you not to contact Jim Powers down at the Murfreesboro Free Press and blab all about your son's accomplishments and heroism over here in Iraq. Though I understand how you must be longing to do so. As you would say, you're fairly bursting the buttons with pride and joy. No, Mother, no, we must keep this between ourselves. But I suppose if you want to share it with the other ladies in your Sunday circle, then I would understand. But those First Redemption ladies must, under no circumstances, tell their husbands. Well, Mother, I have rambled on long enough, and you are probably tired of staring at the computer screen, so I will sign off now. Oh, by the way, if you could see fit to slip a couple of pairs of black socks, the over-the-calf variety, into your next care package, they would not go unappreciated. Also, some more dried apricots. Your loving son, Stacy. So, that's Stacy. Thank you. So, that's an introduction to one of the many characters in the book. I thank you all for coming. This was a wonderful experience, a great Tattered Cover experience. So, thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.